Greetings, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Way of the Showman, where we view the world through the lens of showmanship. I am Captain Frodo, and I will be your gracious host, and I will be your guide along the way. And this episode, episode 70, will be the third annual birthday ramble. It so happens that my birthday is the same day as the pandemic really started, the 12th of March, as this episode is released on that day. So, each year since the pandemic, I've kind of taken stock of the situation. It sort of becomes a little bit of an time to reflect back on what has changed, because a big change happened in my life, as it did for all of us who follow the Way of the Showman, not just follow the podcast, but who are out there on the road making a living and making a life from presenting wonderful creations for beautiful audiences around the world. We were all knocked sideways completely, or some of us completely knocked right off the horse or knocked off the showboat we were on, lying there, splashing about in the fantasy as the showmanship sailed away. But anyway, this is what this episode then tried to take stock of it. Where am I at now? And one of the main things that is of importance for us here is, of course, what you and me have in common is this podcast and this whole project came about, or certainly was facilitated by the fact of the pandemic. As the first episode here on the podcast is the day that Showbiz died, that formed the start of this journey that we've been on. And when I listen back, or when I have conversations with people who have listened to the earlier episodes, they are of course tinged by the pandemic as it is unfolding, and I'm responding to things as I go through those episodes. I was wondering about whether that would be a wise move, because I wanted the episodes, of course, to be sort of timeless, but it has become an interesting document, or a documentation of what was going on. I had my pre-prepared essays that I read and commented on, but there's these little tidbits along the way of me, what my emotional state is at. So, that was the first year. But the second year, which is sort of where we've had the second season, which now has come to an end in episode 35, where I wrote a book during the pandemic. And I'm sometimes asked about a reading list, or what kind of books I've read that inspired this. And the reading list doesn't include so many show books or books on performing or whatever. They're drawn from philosophy and from sociology and from whatever it is that I'm reading, all these books, and I'm kind of always reflecting on this material and seeing how it relates to me and the deeper kind of things that I think. And the book that that has kind of unfolded in this last season too, that I sort of took the advice from, there's a great, beautiful little book called Steal Like an Artist, where a guy called Austin Kleon has made a list of 10 tips to unlock your creativity. The first one is Steal Like an Artist, and throughout the book he goes through all these, what they mean or whatever. But tip number 3 is write the book that you want to read. And I guess that is what this season has been, or what all the seasons are there. And I will soon, that's what I'm hoping to do this year, put some of these things into paper form so that you, if you are a bibliophile such as myself, that I love books and that I keep buying more books than I could possibly read, and when I'm start reading a book, so already on page 1 of the introduction when the author mentions another book, then I'm already on straight away going, oh, well, I love this book that I'm reading now, and now I want to buy this other book too. So if you do like to have your information also coming in through the eyes, you like books, then I am hoping that this year there will be the first book of The Way of the Shaman will come out. So anyway, I took Austin Kleon's advice of writing the book that I wanted to read, where I've sort of summed up all these different, all what you have heard so far. So because I didn't make all of the stuff up that I've talked about in this season just for this season. I've been thinking deeply about what I do for a long time, and the pandemic gave me the time and the inclination to not just think loose thoughts, but to place them into a system. And I knew that somehow all of these random things that I thought about, these snippets of insights that I felt like I had, I knew that it was all related. But we all think so much about what we do and what we read and what we watch, or all the stuff that whatever pops out when you're having a conversation with someone, great ideas emerge. But it takes a long time to organize these thoughts and put them together into one long cohesive thought or one book. So, you know, when I write, the first drafts aren't usually very good, but there are nuggets of gold there, but a lot of it is dirt. But I have to write it out so that I can read what it is that I actually think. I mean, as I experience it, the thinking process at all times is kind of unconscious in the moment that it happens. But once I've thought it, then I can go back and I can look at those thoughts and I can think about why I thought it or how it connects up to any other thoughts that I've had or anything that I've read. I think that's quite a fundamental insight about the world, that when I hear a rustling in the bushes when I go for walks in the morning with my dog in the forest, then I immediately, my thinking connected together with the bird, and I see a shape that flutters, and I do all this that's the elements of thinking, but the actual sound and a little duck starling or the little dark spot that flies across, that's from my sensing. But my thinking starts putting it together without me having to think it, like, oh, when I see a bird, I don't go, oh, I think this is a bird. I see that it's a bird because of all the sensory things gets put together with the thinking. Anyway, that's probably deeper than I need to go on that thought. But I think thinking first is an unconscious process, and then we can think about it afterwards. And that is kind of what happens when I'm writing. So I write the first draft to see what it is that I think about a subject. And sometimes it surprises me. And even then, when the first draft isn't excellent, you can't improve on nothing. So when I read my draft, I see what I think. And I can then, in rewriting it and analyzing it, then I can think about my thinking, and I can now see even more links, and I can see more clearly what it is that I'm thinking. So this process is long and involved, and I frequently fall into rabbit holes of research on sometimes very trivial things. As soon as I look something up in a book, or look at something that I've written in the margin of a book, or that I've underlined, or when I Google something or go into my notebooks, whether it's my paper notebooks or on my phone, then I'm liable to just spend way more time than I should on just that. So anyway, I wrote and then I rewrote what has become what I thought was going to be a book. And I thought that I would finish that book and then use the podcast to tell people about it whilst continuing to record episodes more in the style of season one, where they're not quite necessarily related to what comes next. But then it became clear to me that I had to finish that so that I would, so it would be okay to publish, would be such a big job. And as I've mentioned before, then that's what the second season then became. I'm rewriting and shaping it for being able to have the conversations I have with you in it. And slowly the book then sort of took the shape that you have just heard now. And I feel like I need to sum it up now, or that it's okay to talk about it again, because we have just gotten to the end of the final chapter in a what was episode the installment 35, which I think was episode 64, wasn't it? Yeah. So anyway, one of the things that we spoke about right there in the very beginning of this this journey, in about episode 26, where it's called The Secrets of the Showman, where I sort of talked about this word show and man, and we've talked a lot about both of these things. The show is kind of the all the things that are related to performing and all this, and the man is the human being that we are at the same time. We can look at it like that. And if showman becomes like one of those signs with many arrows, then show is pointing towards one aspect of our life, and the man is pointing to the human aspect of our lives. These two aspects of the showman are, of course, multitudes of aspects to us, but there's also two sides, and those two makes up the word showman. So I guess today we're kind of also reflecting a little bit on the human side of who I am, because when the pandemic hit in Las Vegas, I, you know, couldn't help but feel like I was failing as a man. Because when the shows disappeared, although it wasn't my fault, it still meant that I couldn't take care of the family anymore. So my wife, as she has followed me out onto the life of the showman on the road, then I am the sole breadwinner, and it's up to me to make the money that makes the external life tick and go. And I'd had trouble doing this one time previously when we wanted to stay in Australia, and there was so much good about that. That was like 2017 or so, and like there was two other, like my daughter went in, was enrolled to go to a Stein school in Australia, a Waldorf school, and as it turned out, in her class in that small town, it was in Byron Bay in Australia, there were two other kids in her class in that school who also had one Norwegian and one Australian parent. So we were like, oh, that's all great. We really felt like, well, we've landed in it. But then living a touring lifestyle, going on a road, and well, which means going on a plane when you're going from Australia, going to Europe all the time, it just broke me. Couldn't handle all the touring and being away from the family. So that was when the call came from Vegas. So I'd kind of went to Vegas, and we stayed there for 2 years, and we thought, okay, this is it. We want stability for our girl, now this is the way. But then then all of a sudden the pandemic came, and all of a sudden Vegas as well didn't work out, and yet again I couldn't support us. So we didn't really want to leave Vegas, but we had to. So anyway, all of this, it was like, I've talked about this before, but it kind of, you know, led me into a sort of downward spiral. Because anyone who, you know, it was a shock for all of us to be left with no shows. Who would have thought that? But anyway, those who have worked with me in any kind of creation, you know that my way of connecting with someone whom I don't know, it is my way of doing that is always to try and go deeper. Because I do think on a fundamental level that the differences between us, they're always more shallow and more on the surface, no matter what kind of material, skill-wise, or where you stand philosophically, or what you think. I do believe that ultimately we kind of agree. And if we aren't agreeing on the surface, then we just have to dig down deeper, because down there in the human underground, we are the same. And if we disagree, it's just because the connections we're trying to make are too shallow. So when I found myself out of sorts and out of work, and with the loss of meaning that brought with it as the shows disappeared, as then all my oddball behaviors, which forms the basis of my artistic output, they just didn't make any sense anymore. When this then happened, I needed to dig in deeper, because I mean, this is always my approach. So when I'm lost, we gotta go, where is the foundation of this? And this is kind of one of the core points of where this season two has, which just finished, has come from. So, you know, just this thing, just when I can't support my family, which really just has only really properly happened now when the pandemic was on. I mean, I still managed to somehow. We didn't die. But it is my responsibility, and this has been a way for my family that I am the breadwinner, and it's my responsibility. And part of that is because of my wife Miranda's, because of her sacrifice. Because when we met, we met at a fortuitous time. There was only one sort of point in her life and my life where if we met at that point, then what has happened, and one of the best things of my life, the best thing of my life has happened, is that our relationship and everything that's come out of that, was only possible because of a sort of two different things. Like when we met, she had just lived in England for a few years and her working visa had just expired, so she was ready to take on something new. And when we met, I had the kind of a thought that I could never really be in a long-term relationship. I just couldn't make it work on account of my constant touring, because if you're a traveling performer and you fall in love with someone who lives in a town, then things get complicated when the circus takes me back on a road, or when you leave your love behind, because this makes, in a certain sense, it makes you sort of resent the shows. You're going, oh no, I have to go away on tour again, and because your heart is left behind. But if you remove the shows and the circus from your life, then like my whole calling, my vocation, and that no longer works, and then the foundations of my life no longer supports me, and I'm completely flailing, which was what happened in the pandemic. But so I thought, okay, I can't lose the shows, because then I don't know what to do with myself. So I thought, there's never going to be a long-term relationship, so let's just put that on ice, that idea. But then when I met Miranda, and she was at this complete crossroad in her life, she wasn't quite done with traveling and living abroad and that, but with the visa, that working visa that she had for the UK, as that had sort of done, she had headed back home to Melbourne. And at that time we were set up there with Famous Spiegel Tent, when the show I was in was called La Clique. And this show was, we were kicking butt in Melbourne. So anyway, we got together during that season in 2007, and Miranda came on tour with me. She then eventually started to work for the company, doing follow spot and front of house and anything else that was needed, because it was a small kind of crew. Chris Chen and Brett Haylock and myself, and so Chris, who was Brett's partner, and Miranda, who was my partner, they sort of came along for the relationships to function. They came with us on tour and did all that other stuff that needed to be done. So anyway, but the work that Miranda was doing was like, it was sort of supplementary work. It wasn't what you can kind of call a full-time job or a full wage job. So we loved our life on the road, but for it to work, we needed for me to be the breadwinner. And it wasn't like it was a demand made by her or anything that we talked about. It was just the way that it was. She followed me because that was what was necessary for us to be together. And at the time that she was in her life, that was kind of a possibility, because she didn't have roots. She sort of uprooted herself, gone to the UK, uprooted that, and then was ready for, ready to run away with the circus. But as a result of that, she's sacrificed so much of her time and attention on following the dictates of my tour schedule. So we were in La Clique or La Soirée, so one show with two names, for 12 years. and that was our common life with common friends. But after that, it's kind of been all over the shop. We've gone here on a contract and there on another one, and it's not so easy for someone, like when I'm all of a sudden we're like going to do a 5-month tour of Denmark, or we're going to go to South Africa, or we're going to be in America or whatever, then it's not so easy for Miranda to, you know, focus on a career or focus on a project that takes a long time, and all of a sudden we have to pull up the roots and go to some other place. So making money and providing for my family was my responsibility. So when I no longer couldn't, I had a hard time, and maybe outwardly it looked like a kind of depression, and, you know, in a way it kind of was. But like I said before about going deeper, I kind of digressed there. But if I, you know, if I don't understand something, then I try to go deeper. So there's got to be something that makes sense of the chaos. The roiling waves, they're always just on the top. So as we go deeper, there is some calm to be found. And this is something which I explored poetically in the finale episode of season one, which is episode 21, Captain of the Showmanship. But, you know, my discomfort or depressive outlook with the whole situation, it sent me into a deep dive, not just in being emotionally unstable, it also sent me into books and study. So over that time, leading up to and overlapping with me writing this thing, I started to read British philosopher and linguist Owen Barfield. I watched John Vervaeke's The Awakening from the Meaning Crisis, a 50-hour lecture series, which is just absolutely amazing. Also discovered the Symbolic World podcast, where this woodcarver, Jonathan Pageau, he's an Orthodox Christian, and he carves icons, like Orthodox icons and stuff. So, and he is engaged in a sort of deep project on symbology, and that's related to Christianity, but the approach is kind of similar. And, you know, I was watching lots of lectures and stuff, and I was reading Steiner as well, and going deep. And I was also at that point doing daily meditations using Waking Up, Sam Harris's app, and there's lots of great talks and stuff there as well. So all of this was boiling in my head as I started this podcast. And this podcast was my own emotional and intellectual state at the time, reflecting it and that. So I started the podcast before I had worked out all this in detail, but had the fragments and that, but they were like islands and not mapped properly. So I knew it was one big geography, but as I discovered, it was kind of two geographies, as I talk about in one of the early episodes. But with my outer geography collapsing, I sort of retreated into my inner and sort of started going through all this stuff in my head. But anyway, I kind of needed to prove to myself what I felt. I felt it very strong, but I couldn't quite express it. So maybe I sounded like I was well balanced during the podcasts and whatever, but inside I was kind of drowning. So I guess I expressed some of that also that in the Captain of the Showmanship episode number 21. But anyway, all the way through all of this, and I know I'm rambling a little bit now, because these are supposed to be a little bit rambling. Well, they aren't supposed to, but supposed to be a little bit unscripted. But all the way through all of this, Miranda stood by me as I retreated into myself and, you know, losing my financially secure contract, one of the most sweet contracts that I've had. And it just, from one day to the next, it just knocked me on my ass. So when the money stopped, we all of a sudden had a sort of fixed amount, and as this ran out, we sold our car, and that bought us another 12 weeks of leeway. And you know you're in trouble when you're selling your stuff to pay the rent. So that's how Norway came up. And our common goal in all of this was, what are we going to do so that this situation that we're going on now, because this is a dark situation, and it was crazy in that beginning, because how are we going to save our little girl from this dark reality of the situation and turn it into something good? And as I've been pondering, I've kind of realized that that's what my family, the Sandvin family, does. Like, my mom and dad did this for me, transformed reality at one of the darkest times that happened when I was a kid. But all I remember from that dark time was kind of life and closeness, and I remember vaguely remembering being nauseous and dizzy or some pain or whatever, but somehow that's all kind of erased itself, and all that's left was that my family and me was in a small white room, and it was lots of people with white clothes coming, going, and blood tests, endless blood tests. But I'll tell you about my dad, the great Santini's greatest trick, how he transformed reality when I grew up, and how that then got me to appreciate his trick for what it was, and how that made me understand the true power and deep potential of this seemingly frivolous craft, that transformation of something dark into something beautiful, and probably talk about that at another time. But anyways, just to say that this kind of stuff has happened, and the responsibility of me as a father, and then Miranda as a mother, and as it was for my parents, was to transform something that could be very dark and very scary into something that was good. So I needed to do this, create an illusion of this as a good time, or taking this going deeper approach, needed to find a place where this actually was a good time, because there were lots of great things which the pandemic offered, a time of closeness and love and care, and it was a time to work out what really mattered. And the second season of this podcast, which ended at episode 64 with the final chapter from the pandemic manuscript, although it's not quite finished as a book or whatever, and I'm working on some more episodes which will come out in a while now, that will wrap it up. But all of that is the result of the deep dive into who I am, which of course is synonymous with the showman and what the craft of showmanship is. That's all that came out in that time for me, and I was working on that whilst all the time me and Miranda were keeping a united front and making sure that whatever was going on during the pandemic was something that she would look back at with joy. I talked about that in the first episode of this. Just a while ago, she was reminiscing about us heating grapes on sticks by the fire, by the sea in a forest. We were looking for birds, and it was homeschooling out there in the nature, and we're walking across swamp landscapes, and, you know, in a beautiful spot. And she was going, "Oh, remember that when we were doing the homeschooling and all of that?" And during this time, you know, I was not perfect by any stretch. I got angry when I should have leaned in and hugged, and I was distant when I should have been close. I was falling apart when I should have stood strong. Yet through all of these shortcomings, my daughter managed to see my true intentions. Like, over the last little bit, like almost 3 years after the pandemic hit, she still remembers and brought up the other day the huge treasure hunt that we did. We did a sort of Easter treasure hunt with her only lockdown friend, Richard, in Las Vegas, when there was just months before we left to Norway, where she just had one kid to be with. And, you know, they were like, felt like they were truly free. They had to be literally behind a brick wall that went around our pink house there. We had a pink house when we lived in Las Vegas, and they were jumping around and splashing in the pool or whatever that it was that they did. It was in March, so I don't know if they were in the pool. Oh, they were in the boat, that's right. We had a blow-up boat in the pool. And anyway, the interesting thing now is that this long after, my girl's memories of that time, they are nostalgic and kind of magic. Like, she, when we went to Los Angeles on the way to fly back home, and we ordered some extra cups to come up to our room, and we were sort of barricaded in our airport hotel, and a robot, like a rolling robot a thing that could navigate on its own came up and rolled over and had a words come on a little screen. I can't remember if it actually had a voice, but it opened a lid and the cups came out, and, you know, that kind of stuff that now is kind of amazing. And through all of that, Miranda stood by me and trusted that I'd somehow I'd pull through and take care of life. So yeah, all good. It's all very common. And I, because in the end of the first episode of season one, the day Showbiz died, then I wrote, I said something like, I hope once all of this is behind us, the pandemic, that my daughter will remember how we behaved and how our home felt during all of this, and rather that she's going to, rather than anything about the virus. And I wrote that she is watching me and learning how to respond to uncertainty. Connections are being made between us and inside our brains. How I act as a showman in this daily show, that show that I'm doing for my family, on an everyday, then this will determine how this wiring of these connections will be. And I am aiming for resilience, not fear, as the response to chaos. This will be the flavor of my prepared material and all my connections. Fingers crossed I am man enough for this show. So at that point, I didn't know what was going to happen and how it's going to be. But when she now, out of nowhere, sort of reminisces about homeschooling and this with genuine sort of nostalgia, when she's going, oh, do you remember when we did this? You know, when she's saying that, I'm like feeling like a winner. Because I was hoping, that was what's going to happen, and I guess that's then proof to me that I was man enough to make this happen. So, swapping over a little bit, as a couple of months ago, I was at a magic convention called Illusions in Horsens in Denmark. Put on by Sten Pagani, who is an amazing magician and owner of a brilliant magic shop, which actually sells some of my dad. Great Santini's own magic inventions. But there I met some of the best people that I met all year, people I'm already looking forward to very much meeting up with again. Nick DeFat, Morten Christiansen, who placed first in FISM Montreal, was it? And Mario, the Maker Magician, and Mario's wife, Katie Rosa. Anyway, before one of the shows, I was talking with Katie about our kids and, you know, the reality of being a family that has to tour. And since my daughter was turned 10 recently, I asked her if she knew this poem, On Turning 10, by Billy Collins. And she did. This poem, I talked about this poem in the starting of episode 43, I think. Anyway, and she knew this poem, and it is so nice to find someone who has seen the depths in a poem that you yourself have glimpsed. And we had a wonderful conversation about poetry and children, and I mentioned that I had written a poem for my daughter inspired by that poem. So she asked me to send it to her, and I did, and I thought I'd read that poem now. Maybe I should actually read the book, the poem On Turning 10, even though I have read it some 30 episodes ago. So it's about, this is kind of a poem that if you have been a kid, if you have been 10, maybe you can remember back to it, but it is brought home so vividly when you have a child around you, if you know someone, or you have your own child that have turned 10 or that will turn 10, then this will ring very true. On Turning 10 by Billy Collins, from his 1995 collection, The Art of Drowning. The whole idea of it makes me feel like I'm coming down with something, something worse than any stomach ache or the headaches I get from reading in bad light, a kind of measles of the spirit, a mumps of the psyche, a disfiguring chicken pox of the soul. You tell me it is too early to be looking back, but that is because you have forgotten the perfect simplicity of being one and the beautiful complexity introduced by two, but I can lie on my bed and remember every digit. At 4, I was an Arabian wizard. I could make myself invisible by drinking a glass of milk in a certain way. At 7, I was a soldier. At 9, a prince. But now, I am mostly at the window, watching the late afternoon light. Back then, it never fell so solemnly against the side of my treehouse, and my bicycle never leaned against the garage as it does today, all the dark blue speed drained out of it. This is the beginning of sadness, I say to myself, as I walk through the universe in my sneakers. It's time to say goodbye to my imaginary friends, time to turn the first big number. It seems only yesterday I used to believe there was nothing under my skin but light. If you cut me, I would shine. But now? Now I fall upon the sidewalks of life. And I skin my knees. I bleed. But now, if I fall upon the sidewalks of life, I skin my knees. I bleed. So my daughter has now turned 10. But when I wrote the following thing, then she was still 9, and turning 10 really is a milestone. Things inside a child is changing, and new things are coming online in the brain, like there's parts of your brain that have just literally shapes and morphs certain aspects of how the world appears to us, and certain parts of it, of how we have related to the world, is now sort of retreating back. And it's this, you feel both grown up, but you also... as I know from reality at the moment, they don't want to sleep in, she might not want to sleep, she doesn't sleep in her own room. She'd rather sleep in with us. Just, you know, she knows it's a bit silly or whatever, or like that, but she wants to. So you're torn. The world is changing and everything. And anyway, so I wrote this poem. I guess it's kind of like in amongst poets, this is called like a response poem. Because I read that poem that I just read you, and then it triggered this in me. This poem is called Almost 10. The first 6 months you were alive, I did not put you down. I wore you close against my chest for each and every rest. 3 times a day, and often 2, inside my robe at night. And if at all I lay you down, I lay down close and tight. You marveled at your flailing limbs, not knowing they were you. Biting hard a captured toe, you cried with shock of pain. Your feet they snapped, and your hands they grabbed. And some lucky times that finger nabbed, and the shock of pain was mine. You knew not where you ended or where the world began. Between us, blurry boundaries, you and I a span, closer than together. I was formed anew. My task was now to step between the monster's jaw and you. The other night, you woke in fright, distressed by nightmare dreams. I whispered, all will soon be right. You do not have to fear the night. And comforted, you scuttled close, my arm a safer pillow. Off to sleep you go. Like oh so many times, I lay there with a hope that the alchemy of proximity, way back as first you drew the frontier twixt world and you, a tiny ghostly part of me got left inside to fuse and be a part of your geography. Like oh so many times, I lay there with a hope that the alchemy of proximity, way back as first you drew the frontier twixt world and you, that a tiny ghostly part of me got left inside to fuse and be a part of your geography. For now, you're almost 10, and I've long since put you down to wander all around, and this I know is true. The time will come when I'll be too far away to get between the monster's jaw anew. And what I hope and wish the most is that my ghost, my ancient, constant presence, the spectre left of me in you, will stand by you at the monster's jaw, whatever shape its maw, and bear the brunt of bite, us two, again a span, closer than together. Postscript. The following is not a hope. It is a solemn promise that I will come, I'll run or fly, but bandage if it bleeds. Even if you're far away, I'm there if you have needs. So all of these things, I was thinking about all this, and thinking about this episode and all that, as I was walking my dog in the forest, as I do every day, and about an hour through the trees I go, mountains and hills. And this morning, a couple of months ago, Miranda was back in Vegas for the first time since we left to hang out with friends, or to go to our friend Asher and Jordan's wedding, but also to send all our stuff back from Vegas. So 2 years of acquired stuff that we had over there, art and books, and we had to leave it all behind in a lockup when we had to quickly leave. But now we can send our stuff back here because we have bought a house in Norway. And whilst Miranda was in Vegas, I dropped off my girl at school, walked in the forest, and then I started moving our stuff, the stuff that we've gotten in the last couple of years, from our rented house into our new house, which is our own house. So now I live in a beautiful house, and the house looks red to me. I look at the world with rose-tinted glasses, but I'm told that it's actually brown, but that's because I'm colorblind. So we've sold the house in Australia, and so we kind of swapped it for one in Norway. And our bedroom now, where we all sleep, because we're all still sleeping in a bedroom, it has a slanted roof. And in that roof, directly over where our heads are, there's a little window. So we can see the stars. And when it rains, which it often does in Haugesund, Norway, then I lay with my eyes closed after coming home from yet another weekend away, about to drift off. The sound of rain on the window is like the sound of rain on the metal roof of our caravan along the road. And it's been a strange long ride these last 3 years, but finally, we're home again. The storm of the fantasy has finally calmed, and the showmanship is safe and won't sink for a while. Who knows for how long, but now we have a port for my showmanship, one which was safe even in the worst storm. And in it, my anchors are Miranda and Saskia, making sure all my philosophizing, dreaming, and eerie rambles stays on course. They're my guiding star, and without them, I would be truly lost over these last few years. Thanks, Miranda, for standing by me, and for Saskia for just existing through thick and thin, sickness and health, till death do us part. And also, now to finish this up, thanks to you for listening. Now and through thick and thin, and through sickness and health and pandemic. So thanks to you, fellow traveler, through life along your ways, for listening in on these dispatches from the Way of the Showman. You are an excellent person. Rooms brighten when you walk into them. You have more to offer than most. So, with all that said, there's not much more to say. Next week comes another, and not next week, next episode comes more conversations. And until that, take care of yourself and those you love. And I hope to see you along the way.